Please rise. Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Harris, Judge Larkin, Judge Smith, the Honorable Jabal J. Harris presiding.
Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I'm Judge Jabal Harris. In a moment, we are going to begin calling cases. I just want to remind you, counsel, I know that you both have argued here quite a bit and you know what I'm about to say, but we are recording this, so when you do take the podium, please introduce yourself. Each of you will have 15 minutes with the appellant getting an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal with that. Mr. Clerk, if you want to call the first case.
First case, A23-1712, State of Minnesota Respondent versus Christopher Gregory Roth, appellant.
And counsel, you can begin when you are ready.
May it please the court, your honors, Mr. Marker. My name is John Munnins. I represent the appellant, Christopher Roth, in today's case. There were a number of plain errors, individually and cumulatively, that deprived Mr. Roth of a fair trial. Therefore, we respectfully request that this court reverse his conviction and grant him a new trial. There were four issues raised, as well as a cumulative effect of errors issues raised. I would like to focus today on the fourth and first issue, if I can, at least to start. The fourth issue is the tailoring of testimony issue. And I think after reading the briefs, the state and I have a lot of agreement here in terms of what the law is. I don't think there's any dispute that a prosecutor cannot infer or indicate that a defendant has tailored their testimony. It violates their right to be present at trial and potentially their right to counsel, depending on the circumstances. The distinction that the state makes in this case is they point to Lutschaff, a Minnesota Court of Appeals case from 2009. In Lutschaff, it was essentially a road rage case where the defendant passed by a victim and brandished a firearm and pointed it at her. When he testified then, he said that she had sunglasses on and was having trouble on her phone, which was a material fact that could indicate that maybe she mistook what he said was his finger for a firearm. The prosecutor in that case asked two questions that brought the tailoring argument, which was, you got to listen to the testimony here of the victim, right? He said, yes, I did. And then he asked, she didn't get to listen to yours. He said, I don't know. That was the extent of the pocket. It was two questions, very narrow. And the court there did caution it, saying it was an incredibly close case. However, they distinguished it from the general rule and found that there was at least some minimal evidence of tailoring because of the material nature of the facts added to the defendant's statement, namely that she was wearing these sunglasses and had her cell phone out that day. That is not what we have here. It's not even close. Here, the state spent about half its cross going through a litany of questions to first establish that the defendant had heard the 911 call, had heard the victim's father testify, had reviewed the evidence prior to the trial even. A very concerning question comes at that point where he says, the prosecutor asked, you even had a chance to discuss that, clearly implicating that he might have discussed the evidence with his attorney. She then goes on, noting the evidence that he had reviewed during the actual course of the trial itself, not just prior to the trial. She confirmed that he was the only witness who had been able to review all of the evidence. And then after going through what the evidence at trial was, reiterates that he had time to think about and hear what others had to say prior to testimony. This was a clear attack on Mr. Roth's constitutional rights to be present during trial and to have counsel. It's nowhere near Lutschaft, which is so small. This one's much larger, and the facts in Lutschaft were so material. Here, it's important to note the prosecutor doesn't even actually impeach Mr. Roth with any contradiction between his prior statement and the statement he gave on the stand. She does this because she's just trying to infer that perhaps he's made up more. And To be sure, the statement that he provides on the stand is more detailed than the ones he gives to the officer Dillon. That's not uncommon. I think if you look at all trials throughout the state, almost every witness who testifies, be it a defendant, an eyewitness, an officer, or a victim, when an attorney does a direct examination, they're likely to get more details, more story, more clarification. It's always going to be slightly different. And if we ascribe to the rule that the state wants to propel, essentially, anytime a defendant gives a statement to an officer, they will always be able to cross on tailoring, which is simply not the law in Minnesota. With respect to the vouching testimony, again, here I think there is a strong point of agreement. There
counsel,
are clear...
Counsel, going back to the tailoring, let's presume, let's say the court finds that there was error here, that the testimony was tailored. Seems to me that the state also argues that looking at Mr. Roth's substantial rights, the strength of the evidence and all of that information is such that even if there was plain error, that error did not affect Mr. Roth's substantial rights. Can you tell me why and how it's affected Mr. Roth's substantial right and what substantial right was affected?
Certainly. I think it's important to note what substantive evidence was actually admitted during this trial, because that goes to the strength of the state's case. And essentially what they had was a 911 call and then an eyewitness who overheard some things and says that he saw my client put MO into a headlock. That is the substantive evidence towards guilt. The substantive evidence against guilt would be MO's testimony herself saying it didn't happen and also my client's. The thing that arises here is that the jury was essentially tasked with weighing a 911 call, briefly corroborated by an eyewitness who was mostly in another room, versus Mr. Roth's testimony of what occurred. And they spent half their cross to imply that he had tailored his testimony based on sitting through trial. And so it's really just, the point of it is that it's an unfair attack on his credibility. I mean, that's the nature of the case law as it is. We always want to be able to attack people's credibility, but it should be done fairly within the scope of the Constitution. And to basically infer that he has made things up on the stand and should not be credible, it negates the opposing evidence that the defense was trying to present at trial to weigh against the limited substantive evidence that the state had. So when you look at that strength of case analysis, it was definitely a very harmful thing to Mr. Roth to have him be subject to this cross and implication that he had made up his testimony and was not credible simply because he exercised his constitutional rights to receive discovery, be present at trial, and discuss the trial with his attorney. With respect to the vouching issue, again, I think there's some clear-cut cases, which is where the state is pointing to, where a witness might testify, this person was truthful, or this person was lying. Those are very clear-cut vouching statements. I will admit we do not have that clear-cut of a vouching statement here. However, that's why I also cited to the case law, State v. Henham being one of the main proponents of it, that, and then cases follow after, where opinion testimony comes in and how it can be impermissibly vouching testimony, particularly in cases such as domestic violence cases. Here we had a detective who was basically qualified as a pseudo-expert, a professional in his field. He talked about domestic violence generally. He talked about the domestic abuse lethality and why their officers go through it because of their concerns. He talked about the escalation of domestic violence and how you can have recanting victims, and how sometimes victims might minimize, they might change their story, they might say they exaggerated or lied. Potentially with a different record, there could be an issue there, but I think with what the case law says, everything to that point is probably fine. That's what Henham says, that's what Vance says, that's what Grenier says. It's, you can give general information to a jury in order to help them assess credibility of witnesses. What you cannot do is then apply that general information to the specific case. And that's precisely what happened here. They get to the end of their pocket. The prosecutor asks, does this mean, you know, after victims recant and minimize, does this mean an assault didn't necessarily occur? He says, no, it does not. But then it gets even worse on redirect when she asks him if he was surprised by the fact that M.O. had recanted her initial report to police. The key here is that it's not just him reporting on the fact. The fact is she made a report. He had already testified to the fact that she then changed her story about that report. That's admissible. That's fine. However, when he personalizes it and gives his own opinion and says that he was not surprised because he is familiar with these people, and this is what she does. She changes it all the time. She reports the crime, and then she changes her story and says it didn't happen. He is clearly communicating unambiguously to that jury that her initial report was true, and the follow-up recantation was false. And that's exactly how the prosecution argued it in their close.
Would, counsel, if there had not been the prior testimony that was more expert testimony, but instead this officer testifying about the experience, et cetera, would you have the same objection, vouching objection? Here's my past experience with them. Were you surprised at recantation?
If he still talked about the past experience and things like that, yes. I think there would also probably be... there might be some type of foundation issue depending on your hypothetical as well.
So, I mean, because they seem like two distinct things, right? I mean, he's talking as a person who's factually dealt with these two people versus general testimony about domestic abuse, right?
And that is the distinction the case law makes. One is acceptable, the other is not.
So if we leave aside the acceptable part, what is it precisely that's vouching? I'm not sure how, I mean, it seems to me you're tying those two together. I'm not quite sure about that, unless you're trying to show it's more prejudicial. But what precisely is wrong with the second part? Let's pretend the first part didn't happen.
So, I mean, the second part saying that he was not surprised that she changed her story and that this is what she does. She reports crimes and then recants and says it didn't happen. He is communicating his opinion there.
So that would have been plain error as well.
Yes.
Is what you're arguing. Okay.
And the defense did attempt to object when the question first came is, what was your reaction? And the defense objected. It was overruled, and the judge said, maybe be a bit more specific, which also created the plain error here. I mean, that's part of the problem, is that you actually can't be more specific in these situations. We want to be general. You can get out general characteristics of victims of domestic violence. You do not get to apply those characteristics to this case and say, well, I wasn't surprised because this is what happens.
So is it the fact that there were previous recantations or that he was not surprised? Just that he wasn't surprised, that's the opinion
part. The surprise part is what personalizes it to him, I think, and that's what makes it improper. It's him saying he personally is not surprised by this. You know, that gives his more kind of personalized opinion of things and doesn't, it removes it from a more general characteristics like he testified to earlier when he just simply talked about sometimes this happens. I would like to briefly just address the rebuttal issue. I think it's been briefed thoroughly by both sides. I would just note that there is an overriding kind of policy interest here in rebuttal, and I think trial attorneys and trial judges recognize why rebuttal should be so limited in scope, and it's predominantly a fairness issue. When you are in the throes of trial and you get done with your case in chief, and you're a defense attorney or even a prosecutor, you know what's coming next. If you're the prosecutor, you know the defense may or may not put on a case, and then you're going to have to put on your rebuttal or close. If you're the defense, prosecution might rebut, and then you're going to close. That's the mindset you're in. You think the state is done with their case in chief. And here, when you allow such a broad scope of rebuttal, you essentially allow them a new case in chief. It throws the defense off kilter. I mean, that's the point of why rebuttal is so narrow. What would be appropriate in rebuttal is something like a defendant making a statement, getting impeached, and denying it on the stand. Well, then you call the officer in and have them play the statement or, you know, affirm it that way. If the defendant said he was someplace else that night, I was at my friend's house, I was at Joe's house, and then the state goes and they talk with Joe that evening and Joe says he wasn't there, you call Joe in rebuttal. It's narrow in scope. It directly responds to the evidence that the defense has put on. And it goes to the prejudice both on issue one and in issue two, really, because it is just unfair to expect people to be allowed to simply come back, retry their whole case, put everything back on, while the defense is expecting something narrow, which is what was discussed prior to Detective Brown's testimony, that he was just going to talk about a phone call. And instead, he gets into all of this domestic violence issues and his vouching testimony. It throws people off guard, which is why rebuttal evidence is supposed to be limited to explain, contradict, or refute a defendant's evidence. These errors were all plain. There are clearly established laws that you cannot vouch for testimony, you cannot come in a form of opinion. Rebuttal is narrow in scope. It's clear under the law, under the rule, under the case law. I think the third issue, which we haven't really discussed, but it is also very clear that you should not be allowed to present evidence which you have informed the jury they cannot use to reach their verdict, but then play it without an instruction even in jury deliberations. And finally, to cross-examine a defendant on his right to be present at trial, review discovery, and discuss that discovery with his attorney is just an affront to our system, and it does not reflect an integrity and fairness that we hold our courts to have. So for those reasons, I respectfully request that you reverse Mr. Ross' convictions and remand to the district court. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I am Assistant Ramsey County Attorney Peter Marker, representing respondent, State of Minnesota. It is one thing for a party in a criminal case to object, for example, to the nature or scope of a witness's testimony, to whether or not to send a piece of evidence back to a deliberating jury or to the propriety of a prosecutor's questions. The court can hear argument on the objection and make a ruling, which may or may not include partial or full relief. It is a completely different thing to not object, make no claim or argument, and then claim on appeal that the trial court's failure to do the thing that you didn't object to is so egregious and so plain that it entitles him to reversal. So when appellant proclaims, like he does in his reply brief, that the state concedes error or even plain error, he's wrong. The state acknowledges in its brief that had appellant objected to any of the claims that he makes today, there would have been a thoughtful discussion and argument on the record. And the trial court may, within its broad discretion, have granted appellant some or full relief on them. The trial court, as this court well knows, has lots of discretion on those types of issues. But whether or not the trial court's alleged failure to sua sponte address these issues without argument, without objection, appellant has not established that on any of these issues. And I'm happy to answer the court's questions as to any of the issues that he raises.
Why don't you speak to the tailoring argument?
Sure, thank
because,
you.
Because, I mean, in I don't know how to pronounce the name of that case, but, you know, we basically said it's not, as I read it, it's not plain error there, but for the future,
knock
let me
off.
Say this.
Yeah. Yes.
So
right.
What, and I think you argue there is an evidentiary basis for doing it. Explain that.
Well, I think that there is arguably an evidentiary basis for doing it. So Swanson recognizes, the Supreme Court in Swanson recognized the evidentiary basis. In other words, if there is an argument that's persuasive to the court that the defendant has in fact tailored his testimony, he's not allowed to do it, then the court, I think within its discretion, may allow some questioning on tailoring. Luschaft repeats that exception. It's a narrow exception. I acknowledge that. Had there been an objection here, presumably the prosecutor would have argued that there was evidence that he tailored because his police statement was quite vague in some respects, and his trial testimony was much more detailed. Now, I don't like that kind of questioning, but the question for this court is, what was it plain error? And where the prosecutor has an argument that there's evidence, this court should not find that it was plain error, like Luschef, because the prosecutor doesn't have the opportunity to make the argument. The trial court doesn't have the opportunity to rule on the argument. And defense attorney, of course, didn't object. He talks about how many questions there were. There were no objections. So I think it's troubling to argue that this is plain error where there is an exception to the rule that could have been argued. And in this case, there would have been a colorable argument. I'm not saying it would have been a winning argument, but there would have been a colorable argument to allow some line of questioning along those lines. Shouldn't be plain error in those circumstances. That's because the objection obviously is designed to flesh out that argument. I mean, you look to the vouching argument as well. Counsel presents a very nuanced argument on vouching.
Counsel, going back to tailoring, so in Luschef, we talked about it getting dangerously close to vouching, and there are two questions in Luschef that the court talked about being dangerously close to vouching. In this case, there's 12 questions. There seems to be quite a bit of questioning that seems to be a little bit more than what Luschef said was dangerously close. So if that's dangerously close, why would the additional questions and the breadth of the questioning here not be over the line and be plain error?
I acknowledge it, Your Honor. There are too many questions here, and it goes further than Luschef does. There's no question about that. And so the question for the court is it plain error? And when I say plain error, not only is the questioning plainly erroneous, but does it affect his substantial rights?
And then the state's, your position is that even if it's plain error, given the strength of the other evidence, it doesn't affect his substantial rights.
Given the strength of the evidence, which I did outline in my brief, it's substantially more than what appellant's counsel suggested up here today. It includes the officer's observations of the witness's injuries, her demeanor, her 911 call, an eyewitness. There's, for a domestic assault case, there's extraordinary evidence here. And it's also worth noting that the prosecutor did not accuse the defendant in closing argument of Taylor. She attacked his credibility, which was her full right to do, but she did not accuse him of Taylor. She didn't say, look, he sat in this courtroom and did this. That's a meaningful difference. But going back to my original point, I think where there is a colorable argument to ask tailoring type of questions, and often there's not. Often there would not be a colorable argument, but where there is, as there is here, would be my position. That can't be plain error.
Was that explored in Luschef?
Well,
the exception that you identify when
yes. There's
an evidentiary basis?
Yeah, Luschef.
How does it?
Luschef says there was no plain error there because there was an argument that there was an evidentiary basis to ask the question. And my argument is that it's the same thing here. It's the same thing here.
And not an inconsistency, but a more detailed trial testimony.
Right. Right. But if this court does find error, plain error, I would ask that you not reverse on that issue because the evidence was strong. It really, we had a remarkable recantation in this case. So the case was laid fully before the jury. In those circumstances, with the strength of the evidence, notwithstanding the recantation, and appellant's complete denial of the incident, with the jury still finding him guilty based on the evidence, would ask that you not reverse on that issue. As to the I do want to touch quickly on the vouching claim. I mentioned earlier, and I think this is antithetical to plain error. Counsel makes a very nuanced argument here today about why this is vouching. the Supreme Court has been clear about what vouching is. Vouching is a witness getting up on the stand and saying, I don't believe that other witness. Or a police officer taking a statement from somebody saying, I believe they were telling me the truth. I don't believe they were telling me the truth. Here are the circumstances in this case. A absolute complete recantation from the alleged victim. She goes so far to say that she can't believe anyone would believe that shit. Those are her words. That's what she says after a police officer responds to her 911 call and sits with her while she's distraught and injured. And how could a police officer believe that? And so it's in that context of that evidence that the state puts on Detective Brown and say, well, why did you basically continue to pursue submitting the charges after the alleged victim gave you such a forceful recantation? It's that context for his testimony. And he says she's done it before. She's recanted before. She had injuries that were inconsistent with the recantation. That is fair context in light of the evidence that was given by the alleged victim, the recantation. In any event, is it vouching adjacent? Maybe. Maybe there's an argument there. But there's, without an objection, without a fleshing out of that argument, this court should not find that that was plain error. Because, that really puts the trial court in an impossible position to act sua sponte in a way that this court just doesn't require of plain error. And I would make the same suggestion as with regard to the other issues, the rebuttal issue. So the trial court, appellant is asking that the trial court jump in and limit the rebuttal testimony without an objection. There's no case that says the trial court has to do that. It's not plain error. There's no case that says that a piece of evidence can't go back to the jury room with the jury if all parties agree to it. And there's no case that says impeachment evidence, which they claim is not evidence introduced at trial, it is evidence introduced at trial, that the jury can consider in evaluating the testimony and considering the defendant's guilt. There's no case that says that can't go back to the jury.
So it seemed like on the vouching, the issue came down to were you surprised question and the personal opinion of being surprised or not. Speak to that. Is that a proper question? Is that admissible testimony? Or what's your argument about that?
So the detective and the White Bear Police Department had a long history with this residence. There had been multiple recantations over the years. And so, again, it's in the context of the jury has heard the victim testify, look, I lied to the police. What I told the police wasn't true. How could anyone in their right mind believe what I was telling the police? I'm furious that these charges are continuing. It's in that context where the detective is asked, were you surprised? No, I wasn't surprised. This has happened before. It's not an opinion as to whether or not she's telling the truth this time.
But an explanation for continued
investigation. It's an explanation for, well, why didn't you just drop the case? That's certainly the way that I interpret that record, and I think that's a fair interpretation of it, especially without an objection. So I ask that the court not find plain error here. And when I say plain error, even if you find errors or that any of the errors were plain, that you not reverse based on prongs 3 and 4 of the plain error test in this case, because none of these issues merit it. To the extent that there were errors, this was not a perfect trial, of course. They never are. To the extent that there were errors, they did not affect appellant's substantial rights, and it is not necessary to reverse to preserve the integrity of the judicial proceedings. It's just not that kind of case. And I respectfully ask that you affirm appellant's convictions. Thank you for your time.
I'd like to start again with the tailoring of testimony pocket. To respond, the evidentiary basis is something that's clear, right? If the state has a jail call where the defendant is saying, I've read the discovery, they said they have this on me, I'm going to just say that. Something like that. Clear evidentiary basis. It's fair game. Go after that guy. We don't allow that in our courts to have someone get in there and intentionally mislead juries. But, Judge Smith, you asked the state. The evidentiary basis here is a more detailed direct examination than a prior statement to police. That cannot serve as an evidentiary basis to eviscerate someone's constitutional rights to be present at trial and have their counsel. It would allow every single case that a defendant gives a prior statement, the state would be allowed to get up and imply tailoring in every single case. I can't imagine a case where a defendant's testimony won't at least minutely change, add more detail, clarification, omit one thing. That cannot be allowed. And the
it might not be allowed if the lawyer objected. What do you say to the argument that even if we were to think this was error, it was plain, you've not satisfied, or the third and fourth prongs of the plain error test are not satisfied? Could you address that argument?
Certainly. The first fact that needs to be brought up is the burden is actually on the state to satisfy that, not the defense or the appellant here.
I misspoke.
But we look at the just case law, we look at the strength of the evidence, pervasiveness of the improper arguments that were made, and then the defense opportunity to rebut. There's obviously a disagreement here about the strength of the evidence. The body cam was squarely put in front of the district court, and the district court said it is admissible as a prior inconsistent statement. Evidence 101 tells you that is not substantive law. It is only considered for determining the truth or veracity of that witness's statement on the stand. It was not admitted as substantive law. That is not part of their case, despite the fact that they argued it to the jury and here to this court. Their strength lies in a 911 call that's very vague and an eyewitness who sees a headlock and overhears an altercation. It is not a strong case, not in the least bit. The pervasiveness is huge here. Almost half the cross of the defendant is attacking him for exercising his constitutional rights. It doesn't matter whether she got up in clothes and said it or not. She planted that seed very clearly with the jury, and they took that with them to the deliberation room. And then finally, the defense's opportunity to rebut here is almost non-existent. I mean, what do you say to that? Yeah, you have to acknowledge the argument in order to rebut it. Yeah, I'm trying to exercise my constitutional rights. I get the discovery before trial begins. I get to talk about it with my attorney. I get to be present during my trial because I'm the one on trial. But I didn't do that. I didn't tailor my testimony. I mean, you have to acknowledge the elephant in the room. And you know, no defendant's going to want to do that because that draws more attention to it. This is plain error. Don't get me wrong. This is a clear-cut rule. Prosecutors are trained on it. They know not to do it. If they don't know that, they need to go back to training. And that's maybe what we have here, is this prosecutor who didn't know what she was doing. Because it was not permissible. It is clear as day. It's been clear as day since 2006. And if you have a basis, you better be ready to bring your basis to court. And it usually will come out in your questioning. Oh, you're telling us that this happened now, right? Yeah, well, but previously you said this. And actually, isn't this the difference here? You point out how they tailored it. That's the evidence comes through in cross-examination if it's done right. You don't even need to infer here at a court. It comes out because that's why you're attacking them to begin with. So it is extremely prejudicial here and violated Mr. Ross' substantial rights to just sit through a trial in Ramsey County and be accused of being guilty because he exercised his constitutional rights. I think the surprise context I just want to briefly address too, The state seems to argue that because the officer was more familiar with these people personally, that he's allowed to say this. That actually gets right to improper vouching. It doesn't matter what foundation you have for believing someone's statement to be true or false. We don't really care. That's the expert testimony. We don't care if you're an expert. We don't care if you're a lay witness who's on the stand. No one gets to say who's telling the truth. That's up to the jury. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. This case is submitted, and we will issue an opinion within the statutory timeline. I thank you both for your time.